A very good morning to you. I'm Georgie Frost and you're listening to Consuming Issues on Share Radio, making that pound in your pocket go a little bit further now. It's that time of the week for This Is Money, when we discuss the financial issues that affect you with Simon Lambert, the editor of This Is Money, and members of his team of investigative reporters from the award-winning financial website Money section of the Mail Online. On behalf of us, the consumer, they investigate everything from scams, bad banking practices, as well as how to keep costs down and what the best deals out there are. Well, Simon is joined today by journalists Ed Monk and Rachel Rickard Strauss. Good morning to you all.
Morning.
Happy Black Friday, everybody.
Happy Black Friday.
We will be talking about that a little bit more with the team. What's it all about? What are the best deals? Is it worth indulging in? Certainly not if you're going to have a bit of argy-bargy in the supermarket. Also, how to cut the cost of Christmas. Also coming up, Nationwide reported bumper profits this week. And digging into the figures that This Is Money team did, they revealed a big rise in its margins on savers and borrowers, credited to a decline in competition in the savings market. So while savers get sent letters telling them their rates are being cut due to low interest rate environment, banks and building societies are actually growing their margin. What's going on? Is this fair? Plus, we'll be asking them, as they've been asking all week, their specialists, what things would you teach your younger self about money? Annie?
Okay, well, we've had a few things come in. Rachel said, I tell myself, it's not Rachel in the studio, by the way, to have never started smoking. I quit last month after 7 years of smoking. I must have wasted thousands. Helen says, I would definitely tell my younger self to have started saving earlier. I'm trying to save for a deposit on a house, and it's a total nightmare. So let us know what yours are. You can tweet us at Share Radio UK, email us at consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. Call us on 02033 849 849 or leave us a message on our Facebook page.
Thank you very much, Annie. Well, don't forget too, every day between now and Christmas Eve, we're giving away a new digital radio to someone who registers on our website. So just go to Share Radio now for your chance to win. And also you get a regular email newsletter covering all the latest developments here at Share Radio.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
Now, before we take a look at some of the stories then today, I've got to ask the team, of course. Simon, starting with you, what advice would you give to your younger self?
My money saving tip to my younger self involved trying to avoid all of the money that was being thrown at people when I was at university in the early 2000s, all those interest-free overdrafts and credit cards and graduate loans. It also involved, once I started working, getting some money out of my account, every month, on payday and into an investment, just into a very simple tracker fund. And if that had grown over time, then I'd be sitting pretty with a nice little nest egg now.
I would have advised her, ask stupid questions about money. Not knowing things is potentially very expensive. And also, I've discovered there's no shame in not knowing stuff. Financial education has become compulsory as part of the national curriculum, but any of us before then, we weren't taught any of these things. I thought when my parents bought a flat when I was about 10, that they would be paying off the previous owners for the next 30 years. I didn't realise that mortgages were that you paid a bank. So I think we've all got secrets like that, things that we don't know that we probably think that we should, and we should just ask them.
You fill all our hearts with gladness then, Rachel, that someone like you could say that you didn't realise where mortgages went, etc, etc. Ed, I've not forgotten you. What advice would you give your younger self?
I think probably like a lot of people, I came out of university and started working with some debts, and I worried about it and I fretted about it, and it really, really put me off taking any time out of work, and if I could earn money I would do. And actually now I realise that taking some of that money and using it to travel, you know, you can do it really cheaply at that age, and it gets harder and harder to do it as you get older. So I think probably it would have been just to relax a bit more about debts at that age when they're not sort of life-changing, you can pay them off. So probably just be a bit more relaxed about it.
That's quite a nice different take on it. Thank you very much for that, Ed.
Really important as well, and because a lot of the advice people give their younger selves is all about saving and scrimping and putting money aside, but it's also important to enjoy your money. You know, you don't make life as rich as it can be just by sticking money in a savings account. You do it through experiences and enjoying things. And if some of those things have to cost you money, just make sure you're getting value for money on them.
I joked with Annie that my advice to my younger self would be to get a job in the city and then went, nah, no way. So let's take a quick look then at the stories making the news today. And immigration has to be top of the list. David Cameron was making a speech a short time ago announcing plans to make the immigration system fairer and stop the current influx of EU migrants arriving in the UK. In his speech, David Cameron said he'll do that by limiting the ability to stay in Britain without a job. He also wants to stop migrants getting things like job seekers allowance, which is about to be replaced by the new universal credit.
As universal credit is introduced, we'll pass a new law that means EU job seekers will not be able to claim it. And we'll do this within existing EU law. So instead of £600, they will get nothing.
Simon, your reaction to this?
Well, I think David Cameron's under a lot of pressure on this due to the rise of UKIP and due to the grumbling in his own party. And what he's said is that he wants to renegotiate our terms with Europe, and he's offered a referendum ultimately down the line. Mm. I don't think that he wants to leave the EU. What I think he wants is to try and give himself a strong hand when he goes to try and renegotiate those terms. And I think there's a lot of people in this country who think that we probably follow too much to the letter of the law, some of the things we're told from Europe, that we probably pay too much money in. We just got presented with a big backdated bill a few months back. Mm. So I think we're going to see a lot more of this in the months to come, and certainly in the run-up to the general election. But I suspect that David Cameron actually probably thinks that being in the EU and having people being able to come over and work here, and us, remember, being able to go and work anywhere we want in Europe, mm-hmm. is probably overall a good thing.
Ed?
Well, I think it's interesting that, you know, David Cameron's got to make certain noises for the reason Simon talks about. You know, he's got to head off UKIP to a certain extent. But, of course, he's also, and perhaps this is even more important, got to keep the business lobby on side. And the business lobby are pretty universally supportive of immigration. They understand that it's good for business to have motivated and cheap workers, which essentially is what immigration can give you. So it's a real balancing act that David Cameron's got to tread here.
Let's turn our attention then to another story then this morning. Two power generation companies are to pay millions of pounds in penalties after failing to meet energy saving targets for low income households. Ofgem has given Drax in North Yorkshire a £28 million fine. That's the largest ever handed down by the energy regulator, while Intergen also faces an £11 million punishment. Mark Wiltshire from Ofgem says the fine send out a clear message.
Abiding by the rules is not an optional extra that these companies can ignore. It is a tough penalty. We cannot have firms failing Britain's most vulnerable households.
Now, Rachel, you've been looking into this.
I think it's just really sad. We spend a lot of money on all sorts of different things related to energy, changing the way we get our energy, energy efficiency. But the thing that really will make a difference to more vulnerable households is the energy efficiency in their homes. And this is energy companies failing to deliver that. They've been given quotas of what they should have delivered and they haven't. There are probably more fines on their way for other energy companies. These are things that will make a difference. It's new boilers, it's cavity wall insulation or solid wall insulation, measures that, if implemented into people's homes, will significantly drop their energy bills. And, you know, vulnerable households at a time when income's being squeezed makes a real difference. And it's great that money in the form of penalties will be put back into the system to help these households now. But imagine if it was done 3 years ago when it should have been.
Mm-hmm. I just think it's worth saying that, you know, this is the latest example of initiatives to make homes more efficient failing or not hitting targets. And I think there's a general problem here of asking companies who make money from people using energy, putting them in charge of making people use less energy through energy efficiency. It's something that, even if the will is there, it just doesn't seem to happen. You know, interests aren't really aligned, I think. And the government probably needs to get a bit more hands-on to make some of these measures work.
Do you think it's going to make a difference, Rachel?
Well, I'm slightly bemused. They missed their targets in 2012. So, yes, government is doing things. Yes, the regulator is on the case. And, you know, they're coming out today and saying how strict they've been, how this sends out a message. And the size of the fines is also indicative of that. But why did it take so long? And does it really send such a clear message when there's such a time lag between when something wasn't done properly and when we see that there's some sort of penalty or outcome.
Simon, we're seeing quite a few of these bodies sharpening their teeth. Is that the right word to say? The Financial Conduct Authority, Ofgem, etc.?
I think it's more than the time of year. I think it is the year and maybe the year and last year. There's been a lot of criticism of some of our regulators over recent years that they've not been tough enough. So the Financial Conduct Authority's predecessor, the FSA, Ofgem's been criticised, especially over rising bills and whether there's enough being done to make sure that, you know, customers are getting a fair deal. Ofcom's been criticised in the past. And I think that there is a desire to show that they are tough and they can crack down and do something about all those bad headlines. Certainly the FCA came out all guns blazing when it took over from the FSA and has been really quite tough and shown itself to be a tough regulator. And financial companies are concerned about it. I think what's interesting about the energy efficiency thing is that from what we see from our readers, they're really interested in energy-saving measures. So if we publish an energy-saving story, it goes like anything. People love reading it. But I don't always get the impression that people are actually as interested in doing some of these energy efficiency measures around the house, like the cavity wall insulation, like insulating the loft and things like that. And the other thing that I wonder about is, I was listening to something on Share Radio yesterday evening, actually, talking about this very thing and about how our homes are much less efficient than they are across Europe and us falling behind and how we need to be doing more. Mm-hmm. But we have a slightly different housing stock, don't we? We've got an awful lot of old homes. We've got all of those old Victorian and Edwardian homes. And those are considered character homes that are very much in demand. And I wonder whether people just go, well, I've got a Victorian terrace, there's nothing I can do about it. And that's it.
Do let us know if you have a Victorian terrace and you've done nothing about it. We'd love to hear from you. That voice you are hearing at the moment is Simon Lambert, the editor of This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. I'm also joined in the studio today with journalist Ed Monk and Rachel Rickard-Strauss.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
So let's take a look then at our first story today. And surprise, surprise, it's Black Friday. Industry leaders suggest internet spending alone will hit an all-time high for a single day of £555.5 million. That's over £385,000 a minute. Police in London have already been called out to help control crowds at four supermarkets this morning on what is expected to be one of the busiest shopping days of the year. In Greater Manchester, the police there say at least two people have been arrested and one Tesco store in Stretford had to be closed after a woman suffered minor injuries when a television fell on her. Utter madness. People have tweeted, Sergeant Paul Marshall from Kingston Police said, even on Black Friday, # shoving people to the floor so you can get £20 off a coffee maker is still an assault. Kadeem Shibba, reporter at the FT, says, unleash the capitalism, # Black Friday. While Willard Foxton says, Piketty's capital in the 21st century is 65% off in Amazon UK's Black Friday sale. Someone has a sense of humour. Very good there. So let's hear then from Martin Ellis from Halifax. He says, analysis of debt card transactions from last year shows it's caught on in a big way.
We've had a look at our figures from last year, and this is looking at the amount of money that's being spent on debit cards. And what we find is that actually, in terms of the volume of transactions going through, number of purchases being made, then actually it is just that the second busiest day in the whole year, and that's just behind the day before Christmas Eve. And it's only marginally below. It's only 2% less in terms of the volume of transactions being made. So it really has become a very big feature in terms of retailing in the UK in what has been a remarkably short time. It's only the last few years that Black Friday has become a feature of the UK retailing sector. We did see, for example, others coming in on the back of Amazon who introduced it in 2010. We've had others like Currys and PC World joining in. But then more recently, and last year, we've seen Asda come in. And so it's becoming more than just an online sort of presence. We're seeing high street retailers getting involved and offering discounts. And we think that's only something which is going to grow. It's likely to be bigger this year than we saw last year. There's been a lot more publicity about about it. Certainly there's a certain amount being done online, but I guess a lot of people will be leaving work a little bit earlier on Friday than they would do sort of other times during the week, and more shops are open until later. So that's catering for the demand, which is obviously there.
Simon, what are your thoughts about this, about Black Friday? It's all gone a bit crazy, hasn't it?
It's, you know, forget your birthday, forget Christmas, forget your summer holiday. It's Black Friday, everyone. Buy some stuff. I think that it's interesting because I listened to what Martin Ellis said there about having seen, you know, this bump in transactions in recent years. But to me, it feels like this is the first year that Britain's really gone properly big on Black Friday. The shops have really been pushing this one and everyone's been jumping on the bandwagon. And I think that it's a direct product of the fact that there's this game of brinkmanship going on over Christmas shopping at the moment, where because the shops have started doing sales in the week before Christmas, people are thinking, well, I'm not going to buy that now because I could get it cheaper in the week before Christmas. So they're delaying their Christmas presents longer and longer and longer. They've created essentially this kind of deflationary effect. Economists say deflation is bad because you would put off buying today something because you think it's going to be cheaper tomorrow.
Yeah.
Well, that's how Christmas shopping works now, because the sales start before Christmas. But people fighting over televisions, stumbling over themselves to do this. I would pay extra money to go shop when there's less people there, not when there's more people there. But what's interesting is, Rachel, you spoke to the British Retail Consortium about this, and they said that there is this game of chicken, but also shops like these flash sales, don't they?
Well, first of all, it creates a frenzy. When you've got a countdown on what you're about to purchase, telling you that it will be either sold out in minutes or will go offline, people get into a frenzy, they stop price comparing. The same is happening, it seems, in the shops. When there's a finite number of televisions, everyone seems to fight each other over them. So they get their frenzy. Also, you can retract a one-day flash sale and go back to charging what you were beforehand. But once you go into proper sale mode, there's no way back, so you've lost your margins. So they love it, and I'm sure that this is just something that we'll see more and more of.
Have a listen to this.
Guys, seriously, you need to calm down before someone gets hurt, yeah?
Please!
So everyone take one TV out tonight, and that's it.
Yeah?
Because none of you are going to get TV.
Well, there you go. That was what happened when the doors opened at a branch of Asda in North London this morning. In Greater Manchester, two people were arrested after fights broke out over discounted items in supermarkets across the country. Greater Manchester police, who were called to 7 Tesco stores last night, made 3 arrests. They're not happy. Chief Constable Sir Peter Fay, he said the events of last night were totally predictable, and I'm disappointed that stores did not have sufficient security staff on duty.
Recording included the line from the member of shop staff, "Everyone, please take only one TV
no.
at a time." Now,
do you need?
I really struggle to believe that people need to buy more than one television at a time. This is being whipped up by the shops. I mean, there are some deals out there. People are getting money off, and if you can get money off something that you were going to buy anyway, that's a bargain. But if you go out and buy something that you weren't going to buy and you don't need, you've just spent some money that you didn't need to spend.
Well, John Hannett from the Shop Workers Union, Usdaw, has spoken out today, warning this is a very difficult day for staff.
It will be a busy day, and this is why we launched our Freedom From Fear campaign, which was about protecting shop workers some years ago, and it's still ongoing. And of course, we're coming up not only to Black Friday, but the busiest period of trading, and it's about really just saying very clearly that shop workers deserve protection. And this is based on the surveys and the results we've had. So it's a reminder, it's a gentle reminder to say shop workers deserve respect. If you take retail and the job that people do, sometimes they can confront situations which you can't really plan for. And of course, when you get busy periods, the danger is the pressure's on. People want to be able to get in and out of the store quickly. And it's about respecting the shop worker, really. You want a good service, absolutely true. But making sure the shop worker who gives that service is respected also. So, yeah, there are flashpoints, but, you know, these victims of crime, which really spread throughout the year, can come at any time. Most of the public, let's put a right balance in this, go about the shopping experience in a responsible way. But you've got to remember, you don't know who's coming into the store. There may be people trying to feed a drug habit. There may be somebody who just feels that the frustrations can be taken out, somebody who's just doing a good job. So it's based on our own research. I mean, we surveyed our members, and we had to run this campaign because we were inundated with complaints of people saying, look, you know, I've been verbally, physically abused. And what we want to do really is bring this not only to the attention of the employers, who of course should provide proper protection and training, but to say to the public, remember, this is someone's member of the family who does a good job and should be respected accordingly. Whilst the customer is king, it's important to remember that the member of staff is providing that service, and it's an equal relationship and they deserve that protection.
Well, that was John Hannett, General Secretary of the Retail Shop Workers Union there. So putting the troubles of Black Friday to one side, let's talk to Simon, this is Money Team, about how to make the most of this mega shopping day. Are there any real deals to be had, or are they just getting rid of old stock? Rachel?
I don't know what's wrong with getting rid of old stock, actually. I mean, unless you have a problem with getting not the very newest television or washing machine, then if you're going to get a bargain, then maybe that's okay. On thisismoney.co.uk, we've got a roundup of the best deals online for Black Friday. And there are a few, you know, little gems in there if you can wade through it all. If you want Apple products, they don't normally get discounted, and John Lewis is discounting on them. Good discounts on Amazon, on Kindles, Kindle Fire. Don't know why, but there are so many coffee machines. If you need a coffee machine, it's probably not a bad time to buy one. High-ticket items like washing machines also, there are a lot of good discounts around on those. But certainly nothing to panic buy over. Always still worth you know, shopping around, making sure you've got the best deal. And, I mean, they say that these sales are for one day only, but we do have Cyber Monday.
Yeah, I was going to ask about Cyber Monday as well.
And then there'll be the normal discounting as well over Christmas. There'll be Boxing Day sales. There'll be January sales. If you don't get whatever item it is right now, you'll probably be all right. You'll be able to get it in a later sale.
What can you do if you buy something and it's faulty, or you don't want it, or you had a mad moment and you think, oh, what on earth have I just done? Do the same rights apply?
Absolutely, particularly for buying online. If you decide you don't want it, you've got 14 days. Most retailers will have a reasonable policy on refunds. A lot of them will extend their refund period till sometime after Christmas. So if you buy a present for someone and they don't like it, then you should be covered for that. And it's always worth checking before you buy something. Some are awkward, shoes, things like that. It can be more difficult to take back if you don't like them. If something's faulty, then you can always take it back regardless of retailer or time of year.
It's all really rather staggering, isn't it? But if you can't beat them, join them, eh? Perhaps? Are you guys going to be picking up bargains?
I probably won't be shopping in Black Friday today, if I'm going to be
entirely
honest.
Doesn't surprise me, Simon.
But I'm one of those people who I'm involved in the game of brinkmanship, not necessarily because I'm trying to play chicken with the shops on lower prices, but because I'm absolutely terrible at organising my Christmas shopping in time. And it's my birthday in the middle of December, so I don't do Christmas before my birthday. So that's my excuse.
Happy birthday for then. Rachel, will you be?
No, I tell you why, though. I think they're just going to get better. Some of the sales are okay now, but M&S is offering 30% off. I think Asda is offering 30% off toys. It's all right, but it's not sort of mind-boggling, is it? Whereas retailers are having a really tough time this season in particular. Wage growth is still stagnating. People have got no money. They're hesitant to part with their cash. Plus, we've had a very warm winter. So there's a huge surplus of stock that retailers have that they'll be trying to get rid of. I think 30%. We're going to end up doing a lot better than that, so I'm going to wait.
Ed?
Well, I probably won't be, but I will confess, you see, you know, people queuing up and sort of getting these cheap things, and there is, you do sort of have that flicker of, well, maybe I'm missing out, you know, maybe there is, maybe I do want a telly for £100 or whatever it is, and I would just caution people to whatever the discount says it is, do the maths, and if it's 70% off, work out what it would have been full price. Is it good value? Is it a genuine deal? Do you really want it? I think a lot of people, if they did that, would walk away. Yeah. And there's we've got a screen here. I was looking at the images of people in these shops. It looks absolutely awful.
Carnage. You know,
yeah, sort of genuinely violent. Yeah, not pleasant at all. So I won't join in.
That said, if Ed does go out for a sandwich at lunchtime today and walks past a queue, he may come back into the office clutching three TVs.
Yeah, don't rule that out.
But there is that psychology of shopping that you were talking about there, isn't it? We don't want a fear of missing out, I think they call it nowadays.
Mm. We've got some comments here, actually, from readers who are distinctly unconvinced by Black Friday. And one of them says, Dougie in Plaxdale says, this consumer junk devalues and enslaves you. Wise up, save your money, pay down debts, credit cards, loans, self-imposed austerity. Sounds like a promising Christmas there.
Sounds like what you'd write, Simon.
I'm not that bad. But another person said, Black Friday, am I the only person who recognises this term as human stroke consumer behavioural programming? And I think there's probably a reasonable point there to be made.
It probably is. Well, we spoke to these people in North London this morning and they said it was fairly chaotic.
It was quite busy. We couldn't pass through here, but we luckily got it. People think that if there's a bargain, that whether they need it or not, they just buy it. That's the thing, because it's a bargain.
Well, coming up next, we'll look at a story that makes Simon's blood boil. Why is it that savers' interest rates continue to fall, but building societies in particular are reporting big profits?
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
Now, this next story in particular is a big bugbear of yours, Simon. Tell us about it.
Well, over the past 2 years, savers have suffered quite badly. They've seen their rates steadily cut by our banks and building societies. And the excuse has been always surrounding a difficult low interest rate environment. The banks and building societies like to try and get the message across that they're really trying here, they're really trying to offer you a good savings rate, but they've got no choice but to cut your savings rate. And you'll often get the letter or the email that tells you the bad news, and it will even include some words like a still great rate, or, you know,
weasel words,
market leading,
like
rewarding, yeah, weasel words. Well, actually, if you look at the figures, the margins, the net interest margin, which is the jargony term for measuring the amount that banks are making on that gap between savings and loans, well, that's been improving for the past 2 years. So whilst we've seen 2 years of cuts for savers and savers being told, we have no choice but to do this, actually the margins are going up. Now, I don't really want to pick on Nationwide Building Society here, but I'm going to, because they had the results out this week and they reported bumper profits. Mm. Nationwide's half-year profits were £600 million. But if you dig into the figures, if you dig into the financial report, it reveals that Nationwide's margin has been on the up, and over the past 6 months, it made an extra £336 million in interest income compared to a year ago. And that takes its net interest income to £1.42 billion. And that is a reflection on this rise in this thing called the net interest margin, which has gone up from 1.13% a year ago to 1.48% now. And that doesn't sound like much, but it delivers that extra £336 million into the coffers. Now, that £336 million could have been used to cushion the blow for savers. And instead, savers have seen their rates cut. I'm a Nationwide customer. I think they do a pretty good job on a lot of things. But my savings account has had its rate cut. I've had those letters. And we've got a lot of readers who are savers. They're very angry about low interest rates. They think that they're being treated very badly in this scenario. And they think that savings rates shouldn't be so low. And what this comes down to is that there's no competition in the savings market to offer people better rates. And there hasn't been for the last 2 years. And that you can trace back to the Funding for Lending scheme, which handed out very, very cheap money to banks and building societies and basically all but removed competition for your money. And over that time, people have been told this excuse of low interest rate environment, we don't have any choice. But actually, the margins of our banks and building societies have been going up. And the same things occurred at Yorkshire Building Society, at Skipton Building Society, Lloyd's Bank's margins gone up, Santander's margins gone up. It's happening across the board.
Yeah, we've been hearing bad news for savers for years. Are there any green shoots on the horizon? And what can you do?
Well, the problem is that it's very difficult to see when this is going to end. It will stop at some point. At some point, banks are going to need savers' money again. Now, I had suggested, you know, that it would have ended before now. But there's still that cheap money, the funding for lending money. The horizon for the first interest rate rise has moved out further now, potentially as late as late next year. And all of that just continues this environment where basically people are not getting a very good return on their savings. But there's going to come a point where banks and building societies want your money again, and then rates will start to rise. What people can do about it is make sure that they are moving their money to the very best rate that they can get and not allowing it to just sit there on accounts which might have had a bonus rate on that's fallen off, or just legacy accounts that have bad rates on them. Or we're seeing a number of banks and building societies simplifying their rates, which is a term that usually means they're getting rid of a load of different savings accounts and going to move quite a lot of people into a lower paying one. But Ed, you were saying on the way over here that the problem with this is that when rates are so low and the actual monetary benefit you'd get is so minimal, it doesn't encourage people to switch, does it?
No, and I think you're right, it's gone on so long that there's a genuine danger that people will just forget about savings accounts to a certain extent. They'll you know, we've written a lot about the moving money to current accounts, which pay better interest. Well, that's sort of fine. But it's harder to move your money again out of a current account and into a different one and back into a savings account. And so whilst, you know, everyone's hopeful that the rates will increase in time, banks will need savers' money again. It might look a very different environment then. There's lots of alternatives to savings accounts that are sort of emerging, but are probably less safe, well, certainly less safe than a savings account. And there's no incentive at all to shop around, and that means there's even less competition than there otherwise would be. It's difficult to be positive, but there's things you can do. Like I say, you can look at alternatives. You can look at things like current accounts. It might be okay to lock your money up for longer to try and get a better rate, but it's just very difficult to really beat inflation with your savings.
I mean, the answer is play the banks at their own games. Make sure that your money is moved to the best savings rate that you can get. Take advantage of those current accounts. As Ed said, you can get paid 5% on a current account. It'll only be up to a certain slice of money, but make sure your money's in there. If you've got savings, get them in an ISA, because the last thing you want is to have a paltry savings rate that's being eaten into further by tax. And then there's the question of whether people should be investing. You need a certain size rainy day fund to keep you tide you over in case the worst happens. And the advice for that is usually 3 to 6 months worth of your income. But once you've got that sorted, maybe you should be thinking about investing. Maybe you should be thinking about looking at, you know, very simple investing like tracker funds or income funds, where you're benefiting not just from the stock market, but you're also reinvesting dividends. And it's those reinvested dividends that really deliver the power of growth, because they compound up over the years and you'll find that your wealth grows. And that really is the only way to make your wealth grow. You've got to take the risk that you may potentially lose some money. But if you're looking at it over a long-term horizon and you're regularly putting some money in every single month, then you should be delivering a far better return than you would get on cash.
Simon, it does seem to be grossly unfair, though. And another example where the consumer can do very little about what's happening at banks and building societies. And we heard this week this bank culture, a toxic and aggressive culture inside banks that led to scandals such as mis-selling will take a generation to change. That was according to a report, which then reminds us of what we talked about last week with This Is Money team and your investigation into Lloyds, I believe it was, and pushy selling. What do you do as a consumer in this environment? You say play the banks at their own game, but it's a very difficult game to play.
It is a very difficult game to play, but the one thing I would say to people is vote with your feet. If you don't like what you think big banks are doing, then don't leave your money sitting in a big bank. Go put your money into one of the challenger banks. In fact, maybe there might be an argument for accepting a slightly lower savings rate and supporting a newcomer to the market, or someone that you think is trying to do something genuinely different. And, you know, you're paying a little bit extra to support those people. And I think that there's a lot of anger, and there's a lot of antagonism with the banks, and that dates all the way back to the financial crisis. but also dates back to the fact that we've seen things like PPI, investment mis-selling and things like that. But then there's still an awful lot of people who have their money sitting in accounts with the big banks.
Give us the names of some of those challenger banks.
Well, so some really good rates we've seen mm-hmm. in recent years have come from people like Aldermore, Shawbrook Bank, you know, even Tesco Bank counts as a challenger bank. And that's one that people think might have a decent chance at chipping away. And actually what's really interesting when you read the comments about Tesco Bank is that they're quite supportive of Tesco Bank and saying, yeah, take it to the big banks. But when you read the comments about Tesco, the supermarket, it's like, no, they're too big, you know.
Ed, you had a thought on this?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. We mentioned earlier about lessons you'd give your younger self. And one of our experts that we got to write for us suggested that if ever you're offered a financial product by a salesman, be it a bank or anybody else, that should be a warning sign that it's good for them. Might be good for you, but it may well not be good for you. And so, and if people had that attitude a bit more, I think we'd probably be in a healthier environment because people would be less, there'd be less encouragement for banks to be pushy in how they sell things. And that might bring about a change of culture.
And we'll be talking a lot more about advice that we would give our younger selves in a little while.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
Now, let's turn our attention to one of the biggest financial commitments we're ever likely to make, and of course, that is mortgages. Simon, on This Is Money website, your warning about borrowers in their 40s are being turned down for mortgages that would run into retirement. Tell us more about this story.
This is something that hit the headlines this week, but it's something that goes back to the introduction of the new tougher affordability rules and the new tougher assessments being brought in by something called the Mortgage Market Review, which was basically aimed at trying to do something about all of the mortgages handed out too easily to people who couldn't necessarily pay them back during the boom years. And as part of these rules, the banks and building societies are much more responsible for how they lend, who they lend to, and assessing whether they can pay it back. And one of the things that has cropped up is that they are increasingly unlikely to lend to people in their 40s on longer terms because those longer terms will take them into their retirement. So if you took out a 25-year mortgage when you were 45, that's going to take you to 70. Now, their concern is that you will have retired by then and you won't be able to meet the repayments in those latter years of life. And so people are being turned down. What we've also seen, interestingly, is a trend towards longer mortgages. And this has actually, ironically, been to fit in with the affordability rules because banks are looking at people's incomings and outgoings and saying, well, you don't have quite enough every month to afford this mortgage. But, you know, if you extend the term by another 5 years, then that will bring down those monthly payments and you'll fit into our model.
But, of course, you'll end up paying more at the end of the
day. You'll end up paying more. But, interestingly, this opens quite a small window. Mm. If you think first-time buyers quite often are now not getting onto the property market until their mid-30s. Now, if they were going to take a 25-year or 30-year mortgage and then a lender is going to insist that that's cleared by the standard retirement age of, you know, 67, I think they're probably looking at, you don't really have long to get that mortgage. You've got 5 years. Mm. Otherwise, they're going to be turning you down. And, I mean, Ed, you spoke to the IMLA organisation, which is the Intermediary Mortgage Lenders Association, about this.
Yeah, exactly. They were the people warning about this. And in one sense, this is sort of inevitable. I mean, we've constantly been told about rising house prices becoming less affordable. Well, what that looks like is you go to a bank and say, well, this is what I want to borrow. And they say, I'm sorry, you just don't have long enough left of your working life to pay off this debt. So in one sense, it's inevitable that this crunch will come if prices keep rising ahead of wages. What the lenders will say is that actually they just want a bit of clarification. They want to know that actually they will lend to people into their retirement because for all sorts of reasons, people can have money in retirement. They can save for a pension that will provide for them. You know, inheritance and things like that can come along later in life. So there's the possibility, and lenders want to be able to do this, but what they want is to know that if they do it and they lend to someone who is still paying a mortgage in retirement, they're not going to be on the hook for some sort of mis-selling claim later on where a regulator says, listen, you shouldn't have given this mortgage to this person because, look, their income's going to fall away. They want to know what they can and they can't do.
With rising house prices, like you said, and the average first-time buyer now, what, 35? It's going to make it impossible, is it not? Very small window with which you can get on the property ladder. What can you do if you are in this situation and you don't have resources yet and you're around 35, 40? What is the options available to you?
Can speak from experience here. What you must do is make sure you're... situation, you're going to be attractive to lenders in as many ways as you can be. So make sure your credit history is in decent order, your ingoings and your outgoings are the sort of things they're going to be looking at, are sort of healthy, and that you're going to be in all other ways attractive to them as a borrower. And save hard for a deposit. I mean, that's not always, there isn't any great secret to that. But that's probably the reality.
Is there a problem for people who are self-employed in this regard?
Self-employed people have a genuine issue getting mortgages at the moment. Mm. It's very difficult for them because there's a lot more requirements on them to prove their income, and lenders are still shying away from lending to people who they see as non-standard. So if you can compare it to back before 2007, when you could self-certify your own income, something that did possibly go a little bit too far with what were dubbed liar loans. Now they're looking for quite detailed accounts, a lot of details on income. And there's also something else that's actually related to this, which is older people now trying to get mortgages. And, I mean, a lot of our older listeners or older readers will recognise this scenario where they've gone to try and get a mortgage perhaps in their 50s and they've been turned down because that mortgage will run into retirement, even though they've got a final salary pension. Now, a final salary pension is guaranteed income. You can't take that final salary pension away from people, especially once it's started being paid. So actually, it should be very attractive to a mortgage lender because that's guaranteed. You know, you can't do anything about that. Whereas
someone
in their 30s could lose their job. It's down to they don't want to have a situation where they say they might end up repossessing someone in retirement or forcing them out of their home. But it's very much a sort of computer says no scenario.
Right.
And so where it's affecting people is, for example, people who were couples who split in their 50s or later in life and they need to go buy another property. And quite often they're buying a very, very low loan to value. So they're taking a very small mortgage compared to the property's price. And actually, you would think that the mortgage payments would fall very much within their income, but they're being turned down for lending into retirement. And I think it's important that possibly there's been this crackdown, but a bit more common sense comes back into the assessment that's being done.
That voice you're hearing is Simon Lambert, the editor of This Is Money. Coming up, we'll be discussing the things that you would tell your younger self about money.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Now let's talk about things you would tell your younger self about money. This is all to do with Financial Planning Week and with financial education being added to the curriculum in schools. We've been asking, as have you guys, what financial advice or tips would you give your younger self? So we'd love to know from you. What lessons would you pass on, Annie?
So Rachel has contacted us to say, I would tell myself to never have started smoking. I quit last month after 7 years. I must have wasted thousands. And Helen said, I would definitely tell my younger self to have started saving earlier. I'm trying to save for a deposit on a house and it's a nightmare.
Yes, it is. I would teach myself the basics, as I said. Also, would probably advise myself, and I don't know what you think of this, is rather than waste money on cheap items of clothing, perhaps spend on one more solid piece. No, Simon doesn't agree with that's a good idea.
No, I do agree, actually.
Oh, okay.
I do agree. There was a big thing about that, pre-2007, 2008 spending that basically came down to people buying an awful lot of cheap clothing that they didn't need. Especially in the supermarkets, people would go off to do their weekly shopping and they'd come back with a new wardrobe of T-shirts that had cost them £12. But people often discovered that the quality on those things wasn't very good. It comes down to that sort of behavioural finance thing again, doesn't it, of not spending money that you don't need to spend and making sure that the money that you do spend is on stuff that's worthwhile.
Now, you've had a number of articles out this week in This Is Money about financial planning with tips for the younger generation, mistakes which others have made and should surely be avoided. Why did you decide to do this on your website?
Well, it was actually Ed's idea. It was to try and bring this financial planning thing to life, I think. And I think it has done. We've had some really interesting comments from experts and comments from readers.
What have you been hearing, Ed?
Well, it has been interesting, and actually... One of the interesting things is how readily people will admit mistakes, you know, even sort of financial professionals and even people like us, money journalists, who are supposed to know better. It's important to note, you know, people make mistakes, and it's been interesting to hear about investing professionals being overconfident, for example, in their decisions and explaining to their younger self not to follow the crowd. That's often a theme when we've been speaking to the journalists that we work alongside. It, quite often, I mean, the point you made about buying well rather than buying stuff that doesn't last. That's a real theme, and actually, you know, particularly electrical gadgets. And I can vouch for that. You know, stuff that you think, why, you know, it's obsolete within, you know, a year. You know, it's sort of odd. Tablet, handheld, palm computers that I bought, games consoles that get overtaken in about 6 months. There's lots of regret around that. But as well as lots of sort of good advice around paying off debts earlier if you possibly can and saving more.
It reminds me of what you said earlier, Rachel, about the fact that some people are just too ashamed to ask the silly questions. And actually, there aren't any silly questions if you want to know the answer.
That's it. And I think half the reason why banks have been able to get away with what they have over the last few years, you know, mis-selling or selling you current accounts that you don't need. I think people are too shy to say, hang on, why do I need this? Why is this in my interests? You have to ask those questions.
Teaching people the basics of interest rates and percentages and things like that is almost... you know, one of the most important things. And you could do that in maths, the basics of simple economics. Maybe actually what would be important to teach people about is that whole behavioural finance element, the teach people how people try and catch you out. I mean, we've seen quite a lot of support for teaching financial planning in schools, and I think that is a good thing. We've got a comment from someone who says, financial planning must be taught in schools. I left school in 1918 knowing nothing and continued to know nothing for many, many years. Many others in the same boat. Teach them young. And someone else said, I agree, in particular, teach them about how a payday loan type debt could ruin their lives. And then someone else has said, maybe in schools they should teach them to look at what opportunities that are out there, what job vacancies there are and skills and qualifications you need, and plan ahead on that. And then we've got some other more specific tips. Save a third of your net pay into a mixture of your pension and savings account. I did, and I'm retired at 55. We have a pension income of double life needs and a mortgage free. I have plenty in the bank and I'm living the life of Riley in the south of France. That sounds very promising. Although a reader has actually replied to that and said, no doubt you've had very good jobs though.
I'm going to throw a spanner into the works as well and suggest perhaps it's a very different environment now for our young people. And are we not being a little bit patronising by suggesting that the advice we can give to our younger selves is relevant anymore?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And something we were talking about on the way over here is that we're all, myself, Ed and Rachel, are all broadly from the same generation. And I don't think that the older generation, my parents' generation, the baby boom generation, completely understand quite how much money was thrown at people when we were in our 20s at university. And taking that up has caused many of my friends many problems in later life, problems that are still affecting them now, 10 years later. Those credit card debts that they built up for the credit cards that were thrown at them, the £2,000 overdrafts, the loan to clear the overdraft, and then your overdraft was reset. I mean, there's all the PPI mis-selling. And then also, we don't necessarily recognise the problems that affect the people who are now in their late teens and their early 20s, because we grew up in an environment, yes, where there was loads of free money being thrown at people, but if you wanted a job, you could get a job. you could, as long as you were willing to do some form of work and potentially go work behind a bar or something, or go work in a shop, you could get a job when I was 20. That is not true now for most people. There's people fighting for those jobs in bars, fighting for those jobs in shops. There's 50, 60 applicants. And it's very difficult to teach someone about saving money and putting money aside when they can't even manage to earn the money in the first place.
Ed, the final word from you on this?
Well, I think actually I'm hopeful that younger people will be okay, actually. They're growing up in a far tougher environment for all the reasons that Simon talks about. And they're going to have to learn younger. And actually, from the correspondence and the comments and stuff that we get from younger people, they seem willing to do that. They understand that it's a tougher world. And I think they'll learn fast.
Thank you very much to This Is Money team, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Editor Simon Lambert's been joined today by journalists Ed Monk and Rachel Rickard-Strauss. They'll be back next week. Simon, what are you looking at this coming week, and how can people get in contact if they've got a story for you guys to investigate?
Well, don't forget, it's Cyber Monday on Monday, so we'll be looking at that,
forget?
Of course. No, if you want to get in touch, email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. If you want to tweet us, it's @thisismoney. And obviously, it is the start of Advent on Monday. We are moving into that Christmas period. We're going to be looking at some of the things you can do to try and spread the cost of Christmas. We're also going to be looking further into some of the stuff around savings and investing that we're looking at the moment, and making more of your money.
And we've got the autumn statement on Wednesday, I believe. So that's going to be dominating everything second half
next
week.
Which we'll be covering here on Share Radio. Thank you very much to the team of This Is Money.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.